Thank you. I'd like to thank the organizers for this meeting and inviting me. I have been learning a lot for a lot of talks. Usually I don't have a chance, you know, in the same conference and so on. And I'd like to share with you this, both to the theorists and the experimenters, and I'd love to have feedback. So this new path, in the sense that I've been walking this path a little bit, from a little bit to much more over the last 20 years or so. So therefore, you see some of the motivations, very old and new, and very recent works up to 2000, this year. Yeah, and so we see that the brain, you know, going from the retina and to the primary visual cortex, it's very prominent. Therefore, standing here to look at the brain, and you see half of it is in vision, at least in primates, is, you know, a window to the brain. And the extrastriate cortex and things that people think are much more cleverer, you know, frontal and parietal. So when you talk about new path, you say, what do you mean by new path? What is the old path? You know, why should we depart from the old path and go into the new path? So let's look at a traditional path, yeah? And for people who are in vision, we know there's one way to call it a low-level vision, mid-level vision, high-level vision. And this is a well-known traditional path. What's wrong with this? It's not falsifiable. You cannot say what is wrong or right. It's not awful. And also, it's not precise enough to guide us as what to do. So therefore, to do science, want to be falsifiable, you can put yourself on a spot, and people can tell you you're right or wrong. And so that's what David Ma did. And he said, okay, vision is primal sketch, 2.5D sketch, and 3D model. And this is going on for several decades, and what's wrong with this? In my talk, you'll become clear that there's a huge piece missing from this, and maybe that's wrong. That's why, after all these decades, the progress along this path has been difficult. And to motivate that this is coming from the primary visual cortex, I'm first of all going to talk about what the primary visual cortex is actually doing. And maybe something we didn't think about. And if you really believe that's the case, then vision has to be different from what we have been thinking about. And therefore, in light of this, you need a new plan. And is this plan going to be successful? We will see in the future. So do we have examples? So let me give a first example study. Hopefully something that we never thought about, didn't even ask the question, or maybe was a question asked but difficult to answer. Is that because of this new path that you could suddenly do it? Okay, so the first example. So starting with the first, the primary visual cortex, and it's our old friend we all know from the, you know, textbooks. You know, we stick electrodes in the brain, then put things on a screen and record a response. And since 1950, this tradition started in system neuroscience. Vision neuroscience started from the retina when Steve Kufter found that the visual features on the screen that excite neurons are these dots, right? Whether it's a white dot on a black background, or white, black on a white, and red on a green, and so on. So these dots tie the whole visual field for different neurons. And then we know that some junior members in his group said, okay, carry exactly the same method, but into the next stage, jump a little bit LGN, then V1. In V1, they found it's the things we call feature detector, that excite neurons now become not dots, but two dots linked to a line. So you can imagine each line is two dots linked to a line. It could be vertical line, horizontal line, even moving line, you know, tilted line, and so on. And again, they tie the whole rest of the field. So along this path, you can keep on going. How about three dots become a triangle and four dots become whatever, you know, a face, and things will come out, right? Now, one thing to notice, this progress is really fast. 10 years, they did tremendous amount of work. 10 years, only 10 years. And I've been in the field for so long, you know. It's really, they did it in 10 years, yeah? And then what happened after that 10 years? And it really, they are giving this expectation for what's coming next. What's going to be the next 10 years? V2, next 10 years, V3, next 10 years, V4. You know, progress can be really fast. We've covered the whole, this V1 is 20% of the whole visual cortex, more or less. So 10 years, And another, you know, 5-10 years we can know vision. But it didn't happen. Because as we move on, V1 and beyond, people start to push outwards, both experimentally and theoretically. And then almost 40, 50 years later, people start asking these questions. How close are we to understand V1? You know, exactly, do we really know what early visual systems doing? Now, why do they ask these questions? These are very prominent researchers in the field. This is because it's realized that these standard model feature detectors, you know, filters on the visual inputs, and then you do whatever, some rectification or squaring or normalization afterwards, cannot explain V1 responses beyond a small percentage of the variances. Yeah? And so this is a huge problem. And in 50 years celebration of their 1962 paper, there was a 50-year celebration organized by Neuron and David Hubel in answer to the question that what do you feel are the next big question in the field? He answered, we have some ideas for the retina, the lateral geniculous body, and the primary visual cortex, but that's about it. Now imagine if you're working on V2 and V3, V4, that's really, you know, we're working on vision, you just feel like indeed there are expectations set by their progress. I think this is probably an extreme statement, but maybe what he meant was the progress has not been as big as what's expected, yeah? And of course we can, as a theorist, immediately should ask the question, why? What has happened? Maybe we've been asking the wrong question. If you ask the wrong question, it's difficult. So you can ask the first question, is a lack of understanding of V1 hindering our progress beyond V1? Yeah? So what do you mean by understanding? Previously, when they say standard models cannot explain all these kind of a lack of understanding, it actually meant physiological understanding. Yeah? You put stimulus on the screen and see if the V1 response can be, you know, described by the rest of the field and so on. This is a physiological mechanism. This is physiological understanding. What we also need is a functional understanding. After all, we're trying to understand the brain. So, for instance, if we talk about hippocampus, we say, oh, hippocampus is for memory, yeah? Can we say V1 is for what? Memory? Object recognition? Or, you know, what is it? Yeah, so this question has not been asked. Now, as a computational person or as a brain scientist, this question needs to be asked. And so I'm going to motivate the functional understanding. Functional understanding perhaps is too, you know, is very late, several decades later, but still, better late than never. So, functional understanding. To do that, let's go back to a very big problem in vision, which is the information bottleneck in the visual pathway. So, we have you know, millions of receptors, depending on whether you count the cones and rods, and look at their signal-to-noise ratio on each of these sensors, you know that we will have about 25 megabytes per second of data coming in, yeah? Because you have a 20 frame per second, you know, all these huge images coming in. Now, what is 25 megabytes? That's about 25 books of long novels you have to read, War and Peace, you know. And you just can't read in 1 second, yeah? But you can say this information is redundant, how about do redundancy reduction and efficient coding and so on. Yes, the retina does it. How much can you compress? 10 times? 100 times? About 100 times, not much more, okay? And indeed, it's about compressed 100 times, and you go from 25 books to one book, still too much. You can't read one book in 1 second. How much can we read? Not even one page. Yeah, about 2 sentences maybe, 1 second. So from one book to 2 sentences, and this is not just I give you this estimate, like that. It's actually measured in 1950s when the information theory was on the bandwagon, and people were just trying to measure all kinds of channel capacity in quantum systems. Somebody said, why don't I just measure it in our visual system? Got this number, 40 bits, not 1 megabyte. So that means 99.9% of the information are gone. Okay, it's not, you can compress it, efficient code it, you delete it. That's a very very negative way of saying deleting all the information. The positive way of saying is you select that two sentences that's not deleted. How do you select? You read the whole book and find the two most important sentences and say, I only select these two. Not allowed, because you don't have time to read the whole book before you select, yeah? Yeah.
I think, did you put the arrow going to the singlet?
Oh, sorry. I meant this whole frontal consciousness, okay. You know, you say, yeah. So what I mean is the whole frontal, I should not be, yeah. And another thing is, where does it go? You know, does it go one step to 40 bits, or does it go gradually? You know, all these questions have been, we don't know. Yeah? And so therefore, where does it go? And people in psychology talk about early selection, later selection. So where do you select these two? Do you select late or you select early? This debate is in psychology. It's been going on for half a century. So it's a huge question. And you may say, this is weird. I didn't feel that I'm blind to 99% of the input. You know, I see the world perfectly well, yeah? But the thing is, if you're born without eyes, you will never know you're blind. So if you're born blind, you wouldn't know, yeah?
Why do you ascribe perception only to the cortex?
I don't know, could be, I don't know. What I mean is, this is where you ask people to report what they see, and you know, I don't know where. Maybe it could be subcortical.
I mean, has this been shown that people base those reports on activity in the cortex?
This is only by psychology, human experiment, yeah. It could be subcortical. I'm actually going to touch on subcortical, yes.
Based which reports?
Yeah, this is based on reports.
No, I'm asking Misha, when you say, has it been shown that people base those reports? It depends on
okay,
what...
Maybe it was poorly expressed, but the idea that there's an information bottleneck...
No, what I want to say is that the answer to your question depends on what reports.
What reports you get,
and
yeah.
And what we know is that in the cases that we can make some kind of a statement about physiological basis, the vast majority of reports do depend on cortical activity. So the answer is, to a large extent, yes.
We could, of course, measure subcortically, trying to see how much information is in two photons, and see if 1 megabyte or 2 sentences. That's report from the data. You could do that as well. But nobody has done that yet. But at least from psychological report there. But first of all, I say, do we really feel we are blind? As I said, if you're born without eyes, you would never know you're blind. That's the reason we didn't know we're blind. But we are scientists, let's look at data. Let me show you the data, yeah? Would you be able to tell that these two pictures are different from each other and when what is that differ? If you did not lose any information, you will be able to tell instantly.
One
right?
is more luminous than the other.
Really? I see. One is more luminous than the other?
Yeah.
I see. It is something else much more, you know. This is a demo to show that your data point, single data point by your own perception, that you're blind to a huge difference between these two images, no? 99% of your images, the information is gone. Here's an airplane engine and here there isn't. Yeah, so it's amazing. This was only discovered about 20 years ago. We've been studying vision for hundreds of years. That's why we, you know, unknown unknowns, you know, we kind of presume what vision is doing, so didn't realize this is a huge problem. Information bottleneck in visual pathway. If you think about that, that's probably the first problem we need to address. Functionally, what is vision doing? Before we recognize this engine, we have to select and put this engine as my two sentences to read and don't read other things. I mean, you have to select these two sentences. If you did not select it, you wouldn't tell there's an engine missing. So that's the idea. And then, how do we select? So therefore, vision really, by the way, today I'm, in order to talk about this in a conceptual manner, I'm omitting a lot of mathematical details. Otherwise, it'll be just talk too long, yeah? So I talk by these conceptual things. So vision is like looking and seeing, and looking is to select these two sentences before you read it. Seeing is then you read it. You say, what does these two sentences say? Or says it's an engine or not an engine, something like that, yeah? And so vision is looking, say, you look around, this is the gaze trace of, you know, look around, say, oh, that's David, oh, that's Henry, that's jaw and so on. You know, you select these two sentences and read it, you select these two sentences and select. And how do you know where to select? Yeah? Who's doing the selecting? So this aspect has been done in psychology studies where people usually ignore the neural substrate, but now these days they don't do that as much. But you just look at the box and then the behavior. There's two ways of selecting. One is top-down, one is bottom-up. So what is top-down? For instance, it's when you have a goal, you have a task, yeah? And so your task, let's say, is to find a uniquely oriented bar. In such a case, your gaze will be directed to this uniquely oriented bar. This is your task. So top-down, make your gaze select that. Okay, this is selecting. And however, I don't have to point it out to you, all of you see the red bar, right? Even though most of you did not see that this engine or that engine, all of you see the red bar. This makes you automatically, so these two sentences make you automatically select. You see it. So therefore, whenever there's a visual world, somehow there's a location in it to make you automatically want to look before you even read it, you just look there. Okay? So that's the bottom-up selection. And so therefore, bottom-up selection kind of dominates. It often vetoes our choice. So for instance, you're all looking at me, and suddenly if a dog jumps in, you will automatically look at it. You cannot even voluntarily suppress it so easily. And so therefore, I'm going to, if you allow me, give me a zero-order approximation, I'm going to look at the bottom-up selection first, or only at the time. And so bottom-up selection, and you can ask, which brain area is doing this bottom-up selection? And of course, you know, these things are already asked, even in textbook set, you know, frontal or parietal, because we feel frontal and parietal areas are such a clever part of the brain, and it's just so difficult to have the egg without the chicken to select these two sentences before you even read it, yeah? And so it's like having such a clever task must be done by the clever, intelligent part of the brain, so therefore, frontal and parietal. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is we notice that whatever things that make you select are these kind of odd, unique, pop-out, singleton features. And then you notice that these singleton features could be a unique color, unique orientation, or unique motion, or you know whether color is red or green, and orientation one or the other. So therefore, it's regardless of what you are unique of, yeah? And so therefore, it's not specific to any features, it's general purpose. You know, it could be these two sentences talk about the airplane engine, these two sentences talk about flower, doesn't matter. Things that's important to you in the world, they want you to look at it. And so therefore, the area in the brain that should guide you where to look should be the area that's not having any neuron tuned to any specific features, but has a map of the visual world for you to tell you where in this visual world to look, yeah? And so which areas satisfy these kind of considerations? Parietal and frontal. You know, frontal eye field has a field, and we all know. So there. And nobody would think V1 should be the situation, should be the candidate, because V1 neurons are tuned to, one neuron is only too vertical, but not horizontal. One neuron is, you know, for one motion, not the other motion, and so on. So therefore, it's not V1.
So yeah. Here, when you say look at, I typically imagine foveating, right?
Correct. Use a cut to it, yes.
But in other sensory areas, or in other animals, you don't foveate the sensory stuff.
Yeah.
But I still imagine that the frontal and parietal lobes will still do similar kind of computations. So how do you connect the way that you're talking about it here, which is kind
superior
of foveation centric, right?
So
with those other views?
In lower animals, you talk about orienting. So for instance, a frog oriented to catch a fly, and they actually move their whole head. You still have to direct your whole head, and it's superior clicus that does it. So you could say, well, how about superior clicus? Notice that V1 projects superior clicus. So you kind of get to the, I'm going to go V1, and on lower animals, superior clicus. I'll show it to you.
But still, not everything that we do is oriented. Like I can ask you to fixate and still pay attention to other things. And
that's right. This is only in laboratory situations. In natural vision, 100% of the time, mandatory, you always fixate. This is psychologically classical data.
But we can still, our brain still works in a related way, I imagine. Maybe you think it works completely.
That's true. I'll show you when it actually doesn't work. Yeah, so for instance, you fixate there. You fixate at me, yeah? Fixate at me. Don't look. And then trying to put your hand sideways 45 degrees from you. This is 90 degrees. This is 0 degrees. How many fingers can you see in your hand?
Not very well.
Yeah. So first of all, it's because you have lower resolution. But it's more than just lower resolution. There's something different there. You just can't see. Here you can see fingerprints. There you can't even tell how many fingers. Yeah. So you so even though you say, I can do covert attention, this is called over-attention fixing. Covert attention is like, see from the corner of my eyes, it can't do it. And I'm going to refer to this peripheral vision later. Yeah. And so, therefore, and so anyway, this is the traditional ideas, it's in textbook and so on. And you can imagine, since I'm going to talk about the primary visual cortex, and I'm going to just say, this is my hypothesis, proposed 20 years ago, that the primary visual cortex is the one that make you tell you where to look. Yeah, and so the retina input comes in and it creates a saliency map. And this is a saliency map, it's a psychological concept not proposed by me. It's been around for a while in psychology. And the idea is there is a hotspot in this map of the spatial world, field, then you just look. You will direct your eye movement to it. Yeah, and so this is my equation, A equal to B. This is my equation, yeah, very simple. So A is a psychological quantity, behavioral functional quantity, and B is a physiological quantity, and put an equal sign to it is my hypothesis. So the idea is the primary visual cortex is creating a firing rate map of the visual world in its top retinotopic map, where somehow this location is firing more, and other location is firing less. Even though this neuron that's firing happened to be tuned to vertical, just so that. But let's say, forget about who the neuron is firing, it's just that. And you can see that, once you have this firing, you can see that V1 actually projects to superior cortex, which actually then go to the brainstem and shift your gaze. So the anatomical pathway has been there for decades, and somehow has been ignored. So this data, there's so much data that we got overwhelmed, we did not pay attention to that data as much. And so, and then this is a winner take all. Can superior cortex is a spatial map of the world, at least in primates. Neurons are not tuned to any features, but neurons can read, this is monocinetic input from V1, to find a winner take all location and direct gaze to it. And of course, at this visual field location, there could be other neurons that are not tuned to vertical, but tuned to red color, tuned to rightward motion, and so on. So there's so many different neurons occupying the field there. Whoever is firing most, it doesn't matter, yeah, that could serve that. So in this sense, what we are talking in this concept is neural activities as universal currency to bid for visual selection. And it's just that's it. And this really helps us to think beyond the traditional box of thinking. So imagine, this is my metaphor to think that way, yeah? Imagine you have an auction shop. It has a slogan, says, attention auctioned here. Now, attention means that you want my attention, you pay most, I give you my attention, I look at you, so, okay? And no discrimination between your feature preference, only spike count. And this auctioneer could be the superior colliculus. Yeah, it says whoever pays me more. And these V1 neurons are paying. And this V1 neuron tuned to red is paying 3 spikes, and this V1 neuron tuned to rightward motion paying 1 spike, and so on. And so whoever pays most, and I'm feature blind anyway, because superior colliculus is not tuned to features, but it can count spike. At least for the primates, it doesn't tune. And so that's the idea. That means it doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter whether you're male or female, old or young, you know, religious or not, just if you pay more dollars, I will give you my attention. That's the idea, and the dollars are the spikes, okay? And then in this way, we can have a more economical select solution to what should be the guiding, so V1 could do that. You don't have to wait until frontal areas. And now we can think about the mechanism. What is the mechanism? Yeah, the mechanism turns out that in V1, so this is like a, you know, 2 millimeter by 2 millimeter patch where you see all these color-coded for the preferred orientation of the underlying clusters of neurons. We all know that, yeah? And superposed on top of this picture is a pyramidal cell. You can see its cell body is sitting on a blue patch. That means it's preferring vertical orientation. And it's sending axon collaterals to other blue patches. That means it's talking to other neurons tuned to vertical orientation. Yeah? And you see that this is 500 micron. That means it's talking to areas, patches that are, you know, more than 1 millimeter away. So beyond the hypocolumn. Yeah? And so that means, let's say it's talking to this neuron here and this neuron here. This field is not even overlapping to it. Yeah? And so what is it trying to do? It's a recurrent network. It's a dynamic pseudo-like recurrent network to have like-to-like suppression. That means if you're tuned to vertical, I'm tuned to vertical, we suppress each other by diasynaptic connection, diasynaptic inhibition. So if you're tuned to horizontal, I'm tuned to horizontal, we suppress each other. That's what happened. And so therefore, these horizontally tuned neurons are suppressed. But the vertically tuned neuron is not suppressed because the neighboring vertically tuned neurons are not being activated by visual input. Therefore, this one is the only one standing high. And that's the mechanism. And then, of course, if you stick an electrode recording from a neuron that's responding to this vertical bias, keep on sticking your electrode and then change all these horizontal bias outside of the field to vertical orientation. They're outside of the field. Eh? You keep on recording, and suddenly you find that the response dropped. And this drop is tremendous. Yeah.
So this is known.
This is known since 1972. That's when Hubble Weasel was so celebrated that this is shoved under the rug.
But there is also the opposite law, right? That
that
neurons with
facilitate.
They also facilitate. That's true. And the facilitation usually comes at a weak contrast. In medium to high contrast, usually it's just
you say suppression. They suppress at high contrast?
Suppress at medium and high contrast. In the low contrast, this contextual inference is contrast dependent. So if you look at Charlie Gilbert's data, he looked at a lot of the low contrast, then you have facilitation. If you want, I have another talk on all these things and study by recurrent network and the dynamics. That's another talk I'm happy to offer after cookie, if you like. Yeah.
If you look at higher order statistics, you can generate textures made of oriented bars.
Yes.
So, and I'm sure you know there's a lot of Willis Sagi, and all that, there was a universe of that in the, I guess,
yes,
the 90s.
Yes.
Or so.
Yeah. Their data is very good, yeah.
But my point is that I don't believe that perceptual effects with higher order statistics are consistent with that very, very simple thing. I think that this is going to hit the brick wall really fast. This is a very static type of view of the type of interactions that you need between different orientations, whereas the entire body of work shows that you need to think in a much more kind of dynamic and context-dependent way. Which
yes, so people, since
so
people are interested, let me show you that indeed I have looked at it because it's such complex issues. This is my recurrent network that does these complex stuff. Visual input, visual output by this recurrent network. Textures enhance the borders. Complex textures enhance. These are very, you can say it's high order statistics and so on. So whatever salient this recurrent network does.
That's great, that's super. So now let's go back to where I stopped you. And if you can, but only if it takes you no more than, a minute or two, I don't want to bog you down.
No problem,
it's
good for
this. Some intuition as to how the approach that you sort of outlined there, that to me seemed like irreconcilable with the universe that you are now showing me that you are, aware of, give me some intuition how, because you're talking about...
Turns out that intuition is... So let me give you more. Very good. So anyway, I said this like-to-like suppression, and this like-to-like suppression, because the concern you had, in fact, I dare not to propose that until I made a recurrent model to convince myself that it's feasible, it's workable. And that's the recurrent model I showed you. So let me show you why it's difficult. First of all, this is data is known since 1970. This is physiological data. And then Gilbert and Weasel and Rockland and Lund found all these lateral connections, which usually is a few millimeters long. That means a few hypercolumns across. And then by 1985, Ullman et al. Wrote the Annual Review of Neuroscience. That means there's so much data out there that it's worth the Annual Review of Neuroscience paper. And unfortunately, such a paper usually closed the field. Finished. We don't understand what's going on. Hubert Wiesel won that Nobel Prize. Problem solved. Let's don't talk about it. And so, finished. Until 1990s, it's reopened. Just like that, yeah. And anyway, I thought, gee, is it what's going on? So that's why I built this model in order to convince myself before I dare to propose. First of all, you can see, if you want all these all-to-all suppression, it's a problem. You study all-to-all suppression, right? It's unstable. The idea is you have to suppress each other sufficiently such that this one will pop out. If you don't suppress each other, this pop-out degree is too weak. Doesn't agree with physiological data. However, if you suppress each other too strong, what happens? Spontaneous symmetry breaking. Even when everybody is the same, somebody wins a little bit, the one will win and win. Okay? And so that intuitively doesn't work. It turns out that mathematically, this is a non-Hermitian system. You have to solve this problem that is not familiar to physicists who are more familiar with Hermitian system and so on, and you know, spin gas and so on. So therefore, this is a non-Hermitian system, we have to go to new mathematics, and that's the work before I propose that.
I missed the word, is it what kind of...
Non-Hermitian system, it's not a hot field.
Non-Hermitian.
Yeah, because it's diasynaptic inhibition, it's not a symmetric interaction, it's an antinomy, excitatory inhibitory. So the EI network and all these, I've done that. Because how could you do that?
Yeah. Like the things you showed after with the circle.
Yeah.
So there are experiments that if you take out a piece of the circle, I'm sure you know them better
yes.
than I do. If you take out a piece of the circle
yeah.
and you measure responses in V1, you'll actually see a response where the edge has been omitted.
Exactly. I simulated all these. And by the way, it's the same model.
So the measures are in V1, and the idea is that you get feedback from V2. But you
What is that?
It's a paper in the early 2000s, Lee, differently, and Mumford, and the third author, which I don't remember.
But there's conflicting data. There's one point that she's shown. Okay. Hoop, your postdoc, also did phlegology, says if you lesion V1, cool down, you also
did that.
That's right. And so therefore, yes. If you want, I can give you another talk, 2 hours talk.
Yeah.
Both physiology and recurrent network and the mathematics and non-Hermitian and mathematical proof. It's actually I went to Poincaré Institute of Computer Science to ask for mathematicians to please join me because there's a rich neurodynamics there need study. Unfortunately, you know, just not able to because it's really beautiful math behind it. Yes.
Can I ask a more basic question? What is the anatomy of the connection?
Yeah, this is a parameter cell. This is a parameter cell.
From V1 to superior colliculus.
It's from layer 5 to superficial layer.
In some sense, retinotopic.
It's retinotopic. Yes.
In the superior colliculus.
To superior colliculus. It's layer 5. So these interactions, layer 2, 3, then go down to layer 5. So I really love all these experiments. Unfortunately, not many people here, you know, to look at layer specific manner, and there's lots of things. Yeah.
And a very simple question.
Yeah.
You are one of the two Li and Li.
No, this is my collaborator Li, Wu Li, who was with Charlie Gilbert.
Yeah.
But before that, he was with Chao Yi Li, who actually was.
I'm neither of one.
Another Li, yeah. And now I do monkey experiment with the second Li.
I see.
And I'm going to talk about some work with him, yeah. So, very interesting. And of course, Hubert Wiesel did these things, right? And so, therefore, they did not look beyond the resistive field. Other than anecdotal things, they say, okay, let's not look at it. And so therefore, you can see why V1 and the Christians are having problem. This just says the resistive field concept is wrong, because this change can be up to 80%. It's not an approximation. It's a changing activity. Yeah, so therefore, people just feel very nuanced by this, like, oh gosh, you know, biology is so messy, and therefore ignore it. The classical resistive field idea is wrong, but saliency idea is right. This bar is salient, that bar is not salient, this bar is salient, isn't it? Salient, not salient, and salient. And if you hire a winner take all, that's exactly. So something that's wrong for one theoretical idea is just right for another theoretical idea. And so this is what happens. And then let's look at this again a little bit more. What if suddenly on this bar you are recording, you add another horizontal bar. Now this pops out too, right? cross pop out among bars. You say, gee, that's strange. How does it work? V1 doesn't have a neuron tuned to cross. What's like-to-like suppression? But it doesn't matter. You don't need a neuron tuned to cross. All you need is suddenly this horizontal bar is exciting another neuron tuned to horizontal orientation, and that bar is not being suppressed. So you have another neuron joining in and responding very high. That's all you need.
Are V1 neurons multimodal? So the ones that have color preference, do they have orientation preference?
Yes.
Or is it segregated?
That's multimodal. So ones have a color preference, can also have orientation, but depend on the scale, the preferred orientation or preferred spatial frequency. And because of that, there's a very interesting predictable prediction, which we then later test. If people are interested, I can show you. Yeah. And so.
And it still works for that, doesn't it?
It still works for that. Perfect. It's just, you know, and actually gives a very good handle for falsifiable theoretical prediction, which you can then later test. Yeah. And
how do you know that this comes from intercortical connections? Because I suppose you could get a bunch of it from subcortical to cortical connectivity, right?
Yeah. Subcortical, first of all, superior cortex does not project to V1. Of course, you can say maybe thalamus, you know, povena and all these things. But people have done lesion studies, yeah? And I can discuss with you lesion studies. For instance, if you suppress superior cortex, you can then don't have to go from V1 to superior cortex. You can go V1 all the way to frontal and then to brainstem and still do it. But it's slower. The saccade will take longer reaction time.
But from LGN to...
LGN does not project to superior cortex. There's no anatomical connection.
Talking about V1.
V1 does project to superior cortex, but LGN doesn't.
I'm not talking about superior cortex per se.
Yeah. LGN, so what are the subcortical?
LGN, so...
LGN, but the thing is, to guide eye movement, you need to project to a motor area that does the eye movement. Which motor area is LGN projecting to? And so this is a motor area. You can say V1 is almost a motor cortex. What I've been proposing is as if V1 is a motor cortex.
I'm talking about the competition between the features.
Yeah.
Could some of that arise from LGN V1 connectivity?
LGN doesn't have the orientation selectivity, so it's slightly difficult to do like-to-like suppression. And people have also studied LGN to look at the strong suppression. They do have a degree of strong suppression, just like the retina has, but far less than these kind of complex ones.
And how about feedback about the cortical areas?
Yeah. Say it again. Yeah.
The type of lateral connectivity with the very characteristic type of cortical distance. Mm-hmm. That you find in V1, and actually not just in V1, in all of the early, V1 all the way to, not including IQ. You do not see in LGN. In LGN, the type of lateral connectivity is much more, characteristic of a building a sort of a receptive fields. It's sort of like you can cartoon it as a Mexican hat, okay? Whereas when you look in V1, you start seeing these kind of, neurons from one hypercolon reach out to another. There is a hierarchy of arborization lengths that actually these guys, Gilbert and Wu,
they did
characterized. Also. It seems like the right candidate to be doing this kind of interaction from the anatomy.
And how about feedback from other cortical areas?
I'm going to talk about it. And so I coined it ISA feature suppression when I proposed it. At the time, most data is on ISA orientation suppression. And later on, data started to come out on ISA color suppression. And by the way, this is my rate model of the recurrent network. And so I'm going to, it's basically a rate model of ER networks, which. Of course, the critical thing is to have these connectivities, which is plausible in the V1 and the local. But anyway, then later people start to realize that, for instance, Wackler 2003 and Jones 2001, they found ISA motion direction suppression. They found ISA color suppression. So you have all these kind of suppression, ISA feature suppression that comes out. And so therefore, a unique orientation pops out, unique color pop out, unique motion direction pop out. So this explains the past behavioral data from this hypothesis. But of course, we like to say, can you predict something we haven't known before? Can you predict something?
Yeah. One thing is just the general thinking. Are you saying that salience, this bottom-up saliency is always done kind of as low as V1, or something like this happens in many places?
It's only lower V1. I'll tell you why. That's later. I'm going to show you that. Only V1. Yeah, I'll show you later. Yeah. And so, so from this, can we predict something we do not know? Okay, now, ISA orientation, ISA color, ISA motion. Is there something in V1 that another feature, ISA, this feature, we can predict? What is it? Hopefully, this feature is not available in V2, V3, V4, then you can pinpoint. What is that feature?
The one that Jeremy Shea worked on.
Say it again?
Motion.
Okay. Motion is already here, and MT is to motion. So okay, it will be unique to V1.
Ocular dominance.
Exactly. Ocular dominance unique to V1. So you can say I can have ISA ocular dominance suppression. Does it happen? No, we know ISA orientation suppression happens. It turns out that DeAngelis et al., they also look at the surround suppression. They find that indeed it's eye of origin specific. So therefore, you can predict something ridiculous, which just says my theory got to be wrong. What is the ridiculous prediction? An invisible feature attracts attention, make your eye move to it. What is that invisible feature? Eye ocular dominance, that means the eye of origin. Imagine, so this is my thing, okay. Imagine you let people see this kind of pictures, but you only put it to the left eye and not right eye. And you make them do a task, look for a uniquely oriented dot, they can find it very quickly. Half a second, they find it. However, in one of the non-target bars, you put it in the other eye, if you do that. They will see exactly the same thing. That means this bar, whether it's to the left eye or right eye, that feature is invisible to this observer. However, the V1 theory says this should attract your attention. That means this location should help because, you know, even this is ISA orientation suppression will make this phi very much, but this is ISA eye of origin suppression will make this location phi very much. So therefore, rather than one hotspot in your visual field attract your attention, now we have two hotspots. And so this gives a very impossible prediction. At the time, I thought, gosh, that's the end of my theory. Yeah.
How do you exclude that this is coming from the right eye? Yeah, it could go to the feature of the right eye.
This is a neuron.
For the right eye is what you're saying.
Yeah.
It just by itself, forget about the left eye entirely. It just pops out for the right eye.
But this is a concept. Yeah. This is in V1. It's tuned to a neuron tuned to right eye input and not tuned to left eye input, and it's only receiving suppression from other neuron tuned to right eye input. Yes, this is the physiology, and this is the prediction. This neuron will fire a lot, and if this theory is correct, your gaze should go there. And so I thought, gee, you know, that's the end of my theory. I better test it myself. You know, I should be the one announcing the death of my theory. It's better than somebody else. So I tested it, and that's indeed. I asked the subject to look for this unique oriented bar. And if this attracts attention more than that, you're in trouble. Yeah, indeed. That's what happened. 3 out of 4 trials, their gaze just go to this task irrelevant bar. It's bottom up. As I said, bottom up will veto your top down so strongly that it does that. And because it's so strange, lots of people in the field, even seasoned vision science, find it very strange. But fortunately, this is so easy to do. So lots of people then went on and replicated. And so this is being replicated. First of all, it's a fingerprint of V1 because by V2, all neurons are binocular. So this cannot arise beyond V1. Yeah. And also, this is an example of looking without seeing because you look there without seeing what it is that make you look there. Yeah. In fact, you can make the same visual input and not making people do the task of looking for a unique oriented bar, but make people do the task and say, is there any bar to a different eye, or is there any bar to the right eye? They cannot answer this question if you make all these bars of random luminance.
Still, I don't see how you can exclude that this is driven by the signal from the right eye.
It is a signal by right eye. But this signal is only available.
Not with this suppression, just because the right eye seeing this bar, even if people are not conscious of it because they see all this.
Yeah, you are proposing that this is only this is a mechanism in the retina. Is that what you're proposing?
No.
So in what sense do you mean by signal see the right eye?
Well, this right eye is projecting to V1, exciting some neuron in V1.
That's what I'm saying, exactly.
Well, you're saying that it goes via suppression of the other eye.
But how do you go to the right eye and therefore make this fire more than other bars to the right eye, left eye?
I don't need to make this fire more, I just need to go where the right eye see this body.
So you want the muscle recognize it's from the right eye, not the left eye? How?
If you say there is a feature in the left eye field that attracts attention, it could be also in the right eye field.
Yeah, so there you need a mechanism for the muscle that moves the eye to recognize that this is the right eye and not the left eye.
No, maybe you said, I don't know if this is answered to you better. Can I try?
Yeah, yes. Thank you.
Think about it the following. I think what she's trying to say is the following. If you surrounded that single bar, okay, with many more bars of the same orientation in the right eye, okay, it would not pop out. So, for example, if she gave binocular, if she gave identical images to the two eyes, it will not pop out, okay?
That's
right. Oh, we're done. Okay.
Was the same? So, what resulted for you?
Well, I think what Nava is saying is that if you put the bars in the left eye,
if you put all the bars to the right, it would not pop out. Yeah. If you put all of them in the right eye, it would not pop out. Because there's nothing special about being in the right eye. If you put all bars to the right eye...
No, that's not the comparison. If you turn these bars here, perpendicularly to their orientation...
I know, that's not what I intended to...
Then you don't go to this feature in the right eye, which seems a bit mysterious to me, but maybe...
I am not... okay. First of all, suprachiasmatic neurons do not recognize any features. They only... look at the firing rate. So how can you make this neuron fire more and other neuron fire less? Can you tell me? How? Why this neuron fire more and other neuron fire less? They all have a receptive field, and each bar have the same contrast. It would not have a mechanism to make it fire less.
Maybe there is something basic, I don't understand that. I'm just imagining that, okay, this, if you have two features, one from the left, one from the right, when you receive this somewhere, you fire more.
Because? We need a neural substrate. What is the neural substrate to make it fire more? And binocular neurons will not tell the difference between this in right or left.
That's what I'm saying.
But the binocular neuron could not do. Only monocular neuron could do. And monocular neurons with contextual inference could do. But without contextual, it could not, because we have left-right symmetry. Because it doesn't matter if you flip back and put all these bars to the right and this bar to the left, still work. Because it doesn't matter. Right eye is not special, nor is the left eye. Yes. Yes. Okay, we can discuss. Yeah. So anyway, this is the prediction, and this is also looking without seeing, because in fact, with this experiment, when I told the subject that, I asked you to look for this unique orange bar as soon as possible, not be distracted, and I said, but in fact, you were distracted. They said, no, I didn't do that. They were not even aware that their gaze went over there. So it's so bottom-up and involuntary, they didn't even know. And this is my recent work with the other Li. It's very nice. He's Wu Li. Yeah. So my name is Zhao Ping and Li. So this is impressed. So what we have is first simultaneous measurement in monkey V1 while the monkey is doing this pop-out test. So we have a fixation point first with a blank screen, and then those bars flash out. And the monkey's test is to circuit to the uniquely oriented bar. It could be here, it could be there, it could be different locations here and there. And random monkey didn't know where it could be. And let's say in some trials it happened to be on the receptive field of the recorded neurons. And let's look at these trials. And because the V1's responses are stochastic, therefore in some trials this V1 cell may be firing a lot, in other trials may be firing a little less, even though the input is the same, stochastic responses. And at the same time, the monkey is succumbing to this, sometimes succumb really fast, some succumb really slow, sometimes it fails to succumb. So if the theory is correct, then for those higher responses, must be faster succumb. And so that's what we looked. And indeed, that's the case. This is the response of a V1 neuron. Okay, the red and blue curves are basically two kind of trials. For trials with faster succumb, for trials with slow or failed succumb. And this difference starts to happen at 50 milliseconds, so you don't have time for any feedback from higher visual centers to serve that. And so this is a simultaneous recording showing as if V1 is a motor cortex. Yeah.
What approximately was a saccade?
Saccade is about usually 200 milliseconds or later, yes. So that's why our analysis. Thank you for this question, yes. And coming to the tradition of my physics colleagues always say, when is biology can give me some zero parameter quantitative prediction? You know, that really makes you on the spot because you cannot fit any parameters. So first we have this beautiful curve by Planck's law of radiation, blackbody radiation, and this Cobra telescope seeing data exactly on the curve. Zero parameter, yeah? And can we do that, yeah?
Temperature.
What?
Temperature.
Say it again.
Parameter is temperature.
That's true, that's true. But nevertheless, once you have to, that's true, there's one parameter maybe. Yeah. Okay, and then this is actually zero parameter, but not as beautiful curve. So we actually have a zero parameter. If you're interested, I can tell you how we did it. So we actually predict reaction time distribution, just like, as I said, sometimes the car fast, the car slow. We actually make human psychophysics experiment for people's button press, and it's a distributed probability distribution, predicted and observed with a p-value larger than 0.05 for six observers, six naive observers. So it's like doing experiment on six monkeys. And
so what's your model?
It's not a model, it's a theory.
What's
yeah.
Your theory?
Theory is the equation saliency map equal to V1 firing rate. That's my theory.
But to get reaction time.
Yeah, to get reaction time. Turns out that you don't need quantitative details of V1. All you need is qualitative aspects, like what you talk about, V1 neurons attuned to orientation and color at the same time. If people are interested, I could maybe after the cookies. Okay, I can tell.
It means how do you get from the saliency map to reaction time, is it?
Quantitative, yes.
Because we say there's
no single parameters. I can tell you this after the cookie.
No,
after the cookie, I can do these things.
But
because otherwise, I cannot. I haven't finished one third of my talk.
It's unbearable suspense.
But I'm talking about new path. This is the motivation for the new path. And this is only the cookie time. What should I do? Should I tell how the prediction goes?
Can you just tell us what is the task to which the reaction?
The task is the pop out. You have to say the pop, just like those tasks. Yeah, reaction time to the pop out, and
you
I
have
can
to
predict.
Say or
zero
move your eyes.
What?
You have to say or to move your eyes because the reaction times are totally different.
Yeah, it's pressing
if you
buttons.
You have no parameters.
No parameter, just pressing button. It's amazing. Don't have to fixate. This is indeed quite interesting. If you're really interested, let me show you. Okay, you can say how to predict. It's zero parameter. You can predict yourself. I show you how to predict yourself. Okay. So, imagine.
You can press whenever you want. That doesn't
matter. predicting reaction time. Toy V1. Imagine some cell tuned to only orientation, other tuned to color. You want the reaction time to go to the odd one out. Okay. The task is to press button as soon as you see it, and so. For these bars, they activate V1 neurons tuned to color and orientation. They suppress because it's blue color suppress, green color, and tilt suppress tilt. Yeah. And these neurons, the color one did not get suppressed. Imagine your reaction time to this task is 500 milliseconds. It's because one of the color tuned cells, let's say its maximum response is RC, response to from a color cell. Yeah. And of course, in your muscles and all these, you have this kind of an exchange rate. from firing rate to reaction time. It's monotonic function, you don't have to specify. All it matters is monotonic. Yeah? Candy. Okay. Now have another trial. It's a unique is orientation. Now it's uniquely left tilted bar is responding. Signal its saliency. And let's say the reaction time to this trial is 600 milliseconds. Yeah? And let's say it's because its orientation to neuron is maximum response are O. O for orientation, C for color. So now you have these two data, 500, 600. And now I ask you to predict. You can predict it. What about its unique color and orientation, just like that? And now, both cells are responding. One is RC, one is RO. What should be the response reaction time here with this exchange rate? You have this and that. Reaction time what? 400?
But doesn't it depend on whether I think there's one neuron, many neurons, whether they have joints,
just by
or not?
Yeah.
So
remember, oh, sorry.
You need to guess. You can't just do that.
Remember, I said the highest firing neuron winning the auction. The highest first recorded theory. Maximum firing at a location determines saliency. Maximum firing determines saliency. Yeah? Mm-hmm. This is my theory. Yeah? And so, therefore, when the maximum firing is RC, it determines saliency through this exchange rate and recorded its reaction time. Mm-hmm. That's a proxy of my saliency reaction time. And RO, maximum firing, from this 600. Now you can predict zero parameter. What should be that? What is it? Exactly. Quantitative zero parameter prediction 500. That's how it's done.
Who predicted?
Yeah, so that's how it's done. But that's turns out
your in your model.
There's no model. It's only theory. No model.
Toy model.
That means
toy V1. So this is turns out that this is wrong because it's only toy V1. So anyway, you can also. But anyway, that's the equation. You don't need that. Okay, so that's the equation. And turns out that stochastically you will have a curve. It's not just 500. You still have a probability distribution and another probability distribution. And from that, you can get this. Basically, you take one sample from here, one sample from here, Monte Carlo, that one.
How do you know which one's minimum?
Take one sample here and one sample here, put this in there, and you get the minimum.
But over here, like.
No, but you measure them in independent, right?
That's right. So the one trial, another trial, this is a reaction time distribution for these kind of trials,
okay, so
and this is a reaction time distribution for that kind of trial.
Okay.
You randomly take one reaction time from this sample, and from that sample, take its minimum, put it in there, you accumulate more and more sample, it's a whole parameter-free distribution you just predict, yeah? And turns out that you can see that this prediction is falsifiable. So we did this experiment. You say, okay, I'm going to measure reaction time for orientation, reaction time for color, and reaction time to double. And then you get this and this, and you predict that. You find that predicted observes, are they the same or not the same? They're not the same. P-value 0.0. So this is falsified. Now, that means it's falsifiable. Now, why is it falsified? Because I give you a toy V1. It's not a real V1. Okay, falsified. The reason is because in V1, you actually have conjunctively tuned cells. So your toy V1 did not consider that. That means once you have that drawing, back to the drawing board, you have a third neuron just came joined again. And then that means you don't have this equal sign, but less equal. That's why the it's falsified, yeah, see what I mean? And then you go to the same thing, you do it again, you say, okay, what do I do? I'm going to introduce another dimension, which is motion. Turns out that in V1, all these, motions, color, orientation, motion, color, orientation, motion, orientation, color, motion, and the triple unique. And once you get that, it turns out that you can do exactly another equation going from that to that, analogous. Taking advantage to the fact that V1 has no cells tuned to color, orientation, and motion. That's a qualitative fact we know. Okay, and once that you have this equation with no parameters. No parameters in it, yeah? Just like that equation had no parameter in it. And therefore you can measure six reaction time and predict the sevens. And that's what we did. Six regression time to seven. Exactly on top of it. That's how we did. Okay. So anyway, The nice thing about this is it says, this is your question, this is for six subjects, they all happen to be the case. And the nice thing about that is because in higher visual area, they do have CMO cells. That means if the higher visual areas are involved in such kind of saliency, you would have less, not equal. Just like that, you would falsify that prediction. The fact that you did not falsify the prediction suggests that V1 alone is doing that. So that answers your previous question. Is V1 alone doing that or not?
What if you repeated that experiment with much coarser targets and distractors?
That would be very bad, because when it's too coarse, the lateral connections cannot reach.
No, you can scale it. I'm trying to propose to you actually that might support your idea, because if you repeat, so think about the way that Dennis Pelley kind of scales things into the periphery, so you enlarge things. And then that would predict that you can recover the minimum rule, even for CMO, because that kind of more coarse.
Looks like we have a collaboration. we can talk about.
You have a collaboration with Dennis Pelley, aren't you?
Dennis Pelley. But the thing is, actually, we have some preliminary data. Unfortunately, only me, I'm the subject, so I don't really believe only data coming from me. There's some problem, not by coarser, but making a weaker city. It turns out that all these reaction time is very short with one saccade. If you make things reaction time with two saccade, you let higher visual area comes in and you start to have a gist, then top down start to come in and it become very messy. But it needs further study, yeah.
More for the coffee time.
Thank you.
So you say, for example, if you show many faces which are unhappy and like one happy face somewhere, there will be no pop-up?
Actually, the other way, actually this is something my collaborator, Guy Wallace, is doing in Australia. It turns out that that's similar to another cross and things, but I can talk to you later. Yeah.
But with cross, there is pop-up, right?
With cross, there is pop-up. What I mean is pop-up, you have other reasons. So for instance, for this, there is not V2. But for face and many other things, there could be V2 and others. But by then, the gist coming, you know, you can get a gist within 300, 200 milliseconds. When the gist come in, just say, come to this room, you see the gist is a room, you're not going to have your saccade go there, you're going to look at here. So I mean, you have a knowledge, this is a seminar room, this top-down knowledge start coming, it's no longer purely bottom-up. And that's a little bit different, yeah. So here I'm trying to grab bottom-up only. But anyway, let me go back to this motivation that now that we V1 is, and V1 alone is doing that, you know, what does that mean, yeah? And so we just showed that it seems like it's V1 and V1 alone doing that, and then we have zero parameter quantity prediction that goes well. And now, if that's the case, maybe we should think about vision completely differently. You know, in what sense? And maybe we'll go back and say we don't know what's going on, but what if 1 megabyte to 40 bits and start to happen by then, half a megabyte? You are in trouble. 1 megabyte, half a megabyte, 1 kilobyte, it really is in trouble. What is the first trouble you get? Because V1, you start to select these two sentences. You select immediately, you know, what do you do? But anyway, once you start to select, information start leak out. What does that mean? If you're trying to measure a set of field, you are in trouble. Information is not coming in. How do you measure a set of field? People have found out by V2 and above, the field measurement is really difficult. If the feed forward input is not coming, how do you measure the field? Yeah? So that may be the reason why we're not making progress. We have to rethink. So, bottom-up selection is already happening here. It's an empirical question whether selection is 50%, 10%, we don't know. Yeah? But a new path of understanding vision, encoding, I've been working and then kind of stop and then spending a lot of time on selection, selecting these two sentences. This is inspired by Barlow and many other people have worked on this. Then I thought, V1 doesn't work, so I have to go to the selection and then decoding. So because we have 20 megabytes in the beginning and then 40 bits somewhere here, and now we realize that selection starting to V1 and we have to, decoding means inference, yeah? You're trying to posterior, see what's going on, and so on. And now look, the traditional path have ignored this big monster in the middle. And I like to put this in the center stage for vision. low level, mid level, high level, maybe implicitly meant it, but not quite. Yeah, all these, it's not there. And so if we put this in the middle, the whole idea of what vision is need to be reconsidered. Yeah, and so this is the idea, and I articulate in my book that's having more details. And in light of V1's role, we propose, this is the new path. Vision is encoding, selection, and decoding. And let's look at the first example in this new path. Can we do something and ask new questions and understand? So, a first example in this study. This is what I mean by looking. You select these two sentences and seem to be studying in V1. And then you read these two sentences, inference and decoding going on. And we know that we do selection by eye movement, yeah? So imagine you start with a visual world, and before you start eye movement, let's say your eye is in the middle, and something pop out and make you move there. But before you move there, this is the central visual field, this is the peripheral visual field, okay? And then, this is part of the peripheral visual field. It is the peripheral visual field that make you move there, yeah? So therefore, looking is done by peripheral visual field, and decoding is done by the central visual field. So that comes out naturally. So with this framework, you see, these peripheral and central visual fields should be qualitatively different for computational reasons. And this is a little bit like a where and what vision. It's not. I'm not the first person to advocate, but to talk about this. But I like to advocate and really nail it in. So I'm going to do to show that they are indeed two separate processes. Because,
yeah. Can you go back to I went a little fast.
So okay. Okay.
You're describing.
So I'm describing that decoding. So
visual cortices.
No, it's in central visual field. So vision is three stages. Encoding, this is sampling, measurements, maybe doing Fourier transform or stiffield transform, these kind of things. Redundancy reduction, that bit. And then you delete most of the information, select only two sentences. And then in order to, within the selected thing, you decode, infer, oh, that's Misha, you know, that's Chuck, and so on. And maybe that will make you second look again, okay, yeah.
But how does that map to centen perfectly? Really
because as if selection is by gaze shifts in natural behavior, yeah? And so therefore, imagine you have a visual world. Your gaze, before the visual world appear, let's say it's happened to be here, and then the visual world appear, and you know this might pop out, you may move there, but before you move there, this bit is in the periphery, not in your center. And therefore, deciding to move there is done by peripheral visual field. That's why I say looking is done by peripheral visual field. So looking is done by peripheral visual field, while the reason you move your center there is in order to read these two centers, to see, to infer. So their central visual field is doing the inference. And so this becomes a very natural way of looking at it in this particular framework. Yeah, and then, and I like to show you that indeed makes sense by a demo. Yeah, you have a question?
To me, it seems like a beautiful theory, but I don't understand whether it's a mammalian theory or a primate theory.
It's more like a primate theory. I can later show you something about frog, but first of all, let's stick to primate first, because I like to look into superior cuticles and then later on these kind of things. First of all, V1, yeah. And so I'm going to show you that looking and seeing, although in our daily life we feel like as if they're the same thing instant, they're actually two separate processes. And I show you that one is peripheral, one is central. This is a demo where imagine I want you to look for a uniquely oriented bar. That's very easy there. But imagine if you put a horizontal or vertical bar in each of these 45-degree oblique bars, then you get that. The uniquely oriented bar is still there, but somehow it's more difficult to see, isn't it, to find, is it? It's right there, yeah? But then why is it difficult? The reason is your V1 sees all these bars, because the V1, you know, sees all the bars, but it didn't care whether these bars are on top of each other or whatever. It just sees the bars and sees this location fires a lot, it's most salient, and this location is still the most salient, huh? Because it's still the least suppressed.
But that's not the only explanation possible, right?
Yeah, but the next bit.
No, I'm saying...
Yeah?
there are now three different symbols or four that you're comparing.
V1 doesn't care about symbol. V1, as I said, it doesn't care about cross or whatever.
Sure, of course, but yeah. I'm saying...
Yeah, just wait a second, you'll get it, because I'm trying to rush. Okay. Here, IT, very clever, it thinks they are all axes. These are all axes, and the rotation invariants, therefore they are the same. So therefore, IT is certainly so clever, getting an interfere with something that it doesn't need to do, because I'm asking you for uniquely oriented bar. I didn't ask you to look for X, or uniquely oriented X. But once your higher clever symptoms start coming, then you get interfered. And so what I mean is it only coming if only it sees that it's X. But if it didn't see this X, well, I'm not trying to see. The first looking is did not see the X, but then once you see it, you're in trouble. Okay, so I'll demonstrate to you. The reason I show you that that's the case, and I show in case that this bar is not 45 degrees, but 20 degrees from vertical, see this, you have no trouble because this is a skinny X, so therefore it's not the same as fat X, yeah? So let's go back to that. I'm going to show you this image like that, except it's a whole screen, and please look for a uniquely oriented bar. Uniquely oriented right tilted bar, 45 degrees, yeah? Ready, steady? I'm showing you that you're seeing and looking separate. Ready, steady, go. Where is it?
Left.
Have you seen it? Okay, one person seen it, two. Three. Okay, so most of you after 5 seconds, as if you didn't think you see it. But you said that V1 should be able to guide you to it. Yeah, yes, indeed. Now, first of all, there it is, yeah. But this is the eye trace of observer without training. Starting from the middle, blank screen, then comes Sakar within 1 second. So 50% of trial within 1 second go there. 90% of trial within 2 seconds go there. Okay. Now I demonstrate to you that if you fix it in the middle, you will not be able to tell that, right? Therefore, your gaze went there without seeing. You just looked without seeing. Look at the middle, you wouldn't be able to. So your V1, there's more than 600 items. Your V1 is so powerful. So only if we were able to turn off our IT, just believe in your V1, you would go there. But then, once you went there, before you went there, it was in your peripheral visual field, that's why you couldn't see it. But you went there without seeing. But then, your gaze there, you see it. Once you see it, you're in trouble. You realize, gosh, it's the same. And the gaze then continued hesitating, saying, you're not there. Keep on going. So this is your seeing vetoing it. So this happened to most of you. And that looking and seeing are two separate processes. Looking is in peripheral vision and seeing in central vision. So I then use this to motivate that looking and seeing exactly in what sense they qualitatively must qualitatively differ. Look at this diagram. V1, I'm trying to look at the feedback. And it's known crowding, for instance, if you fix it on this cross, you can see the T. So therefore, your peripheral vision often have enough resolution, you can see the T. But if you look at that cross, you can't see the T, even though you have enough resolution, especially to see it there. So there's something called crowding. This has been a phenomenon that's been studied phenomenologically, but what is the computation behind it? This is something that this case enables us to study. So the computation behind it, I'm trying to think about feed-forward feedback in V1, because it's feed-forward, feedback. Yeah. So to study feed-forward feedback, can some people stand another 5 to 10 minutes to cookies, yeah? So I show people these kind of inputs to their left and right eyes, and they are designed in such a way that if you add them together, it's a grating slightly tilted clockwise from horizontal. If you subtract them from each other, it's a grating slightly to the opposite way from horizontal. And you may ask, why do you want to do that? This is because from my early studies of efficient coding, we know that V1 take redundant input and decorrelate, and these are the two decorrelated channels in V1. Okay? And these two decorrelated channels, now I'm going to study channel rivalry, not binocular rivalry. I'm going to ask observers, do you see this tilt or that tilt? Okay, so forced choice answer. Very brief presentation for only 100 milliseconds. They have to forced choice answer. What do you see? and subject report. And this is when it's 0.1 second presentation, and this is the probability, the fraction of trials report they see in the tilt in a summation channel rather than a difference channel. The summation channel could be tilt one way or another, so it's all counterbalanced. So you see that 2/3 of the time, they see that one, not that one. So it's not symmetric, even though they are the same contrast, yeah? So computationally, you can ask why. Why is that bias? We know binocular rivalry, left and right eye, unless it's too much dominant eye, you are equally flipping back and forth, but this seems to be dominant. And then this is my way to look at feedback. So the idea is this. The retina comes this way, and the V1 comes that way, and higher visual areas are listening to this channel and listening to that channel. They are talking about conflicting stuff. And I love to hear what Nama says about, you know, ambiguous perception. In ambiguous perception, you can study feedback. And I love to hear you. So, ambiguous perception, imagine that the higher visual area say, okay, first of all, if I'm listening to this channel shouting at me, you know, again, I'm not going to write in math, I'm going to just write concepts. So the higher visual area, maybe a monster, Bayesian monster says, if I perceive it, it is likely, which means I have a prior belief, that this tilt must be presented to my left eye and to my right eye, because it's my visual experience, yeah? And since another channel telling me something, I better, you know, it's not quite clear, let me go back and verify it. But I cannot go all the way back to the retina. The best I can do is go back to V1. But in V1, it's already in these kind of representation, so it can only go to the summation, because summation represents both the left and right eye. So it does go back, and then they say, oh, yes, and verify, very happy. So this tick, very happy. But then the other one will also do it, and it'll do exactly the same reasoning. It will go verify that way, say, oh, it's not really the input, so doesn't like it. And so what I've just written is a computational algorithm called analysis by synthesis. A lot of things like, you know, Helmholtz machine, people call it capsule network, whatever you want to call it. But anyway, this is the old concept, analysis by synthesis, feedback, yeah? And so this is the reason why, so I make it a little bit even simpler. This is a particular algorithm for analysis of synthesis. Feed forward, feedback, verify, and we'll wait. So feed forward, feedback, and verify. If match, weight it high. If it doesn't match, weight it low. So that's the idea, yeah? And so therefore, now you prefer that one, because this is a bit veto, this is a bit enhanced, and that's the idea. But if you're doing a peripheral vision, turns out that it's 50-50, no bias. And you say, is that because you can't see in peripheral vision? No, we did a control experiment. If it's not ambiguous, then peripheral vision 100% correct. Okay, so no problem. So therefore, in peripheral vision, somehow no bias. Now, since the bias comes from feedback, the proposal is top-down feedback to V1 is weaker or absent in peripheral vision for analysis by synthesis. This is a test 5-0 prediction. I love experimental physiology because we don't know whether this prediction is correct or not. Okay, anyway, this is the proposal. And of course, before we ask the experimental tester, I can also play a little bit. So for instance, what if you present the stimuli for shorter time or longer time? Okay, the longer time you have, the more feedback chance you have. Then you should bias even more. That's indeed the case. Central vision, the bias grows and grows. But peripheral vision, because you don't have feedback, you don't have it.
What time scale does it go now when you say so the time, shorter time?
So 0.1 second, 0.2 second, and 50 milliseconds. Yeah. Usually this is roughly something we'll talk about, you know, attention sampling, things like that, you know, these kind of things. But you can see, and we repeated this also for motion, for color, so it's not special for orientation. So therefore, it's a generic thing, yeah. And so therefore, this is the proposal. This is my theoretical proposal. Test viable, force viable. So top-down feedback to V1 is weaker and absent in periphery. And let me first test it again behaviorally, because I don't have a wet lab yet, but I would like to have one. We're going to test in-depth perception. Unfortunately, in-depth perception, we have this kind of situation. For instance, if you present this to the left eye and this to the right eye, these two are exactly identical except for the central ring of dots. By the way, this green colored ring is not in the stimuli, I just indicated. So all the dots except for the central ring of dots in the two eyes slightly shifted horizontally, so it created a disparity for depth. Such that the depths, the image, the perception you should see is a ring of dots and the central disk of dots in front or back, depending on this disparity, one way or the other. And then in V1, you have neurons tuned to this disparity. Yeah, the disparity 0 means you're exactly on the same plane, and then the disparity. So this neuron prefers disparity positive, which means front or back. I don't know, forget. So this is this neuron. But what if you make these central dots, you know, rather than black to black and white to white, flip it, yeah? And so white dots correspond to black dots, and so on, you create a different stimulus, which is exactly the same except the central disk of dots, black to white and white to black. And this is called anti-correlated stereogram, but only for the central disk. So imagine you have a V1 resistor field sitting on these locations, preferring this kind of a disparity. But if you put this to this resistor field, you find that disparity tuning goes the other way around, opposite. So what does that mean? It means that this V1 cell will report a vertical disparity here, but the opposite disparity there. Yeah? So therefore, perceptually, if you see this disc in front, put it here, you should see it behind, if you listen to V1. But now that you know, people can't see it.
Well, no, I'm fusing it as we speak, except that because I can only cross-fuse at these distances.
Yeah.
I'm seeing both of them in the back. And I can see, well, okay.
I love to test you. Yeah, but anyway, lots of time people can't see it. Okay, this is actually, whenever people can see it, they can find an artifact. They cannot.
Sure.
So, yeah.
But somebody that just means that I don't get its surface.
Okay. And I think the reason you see it, it may be a little bit clear. I want to verify why.
Okay.
And so the idea is, put it into my framework. I say V1 is actually telling higher visual areas that this is the opposite depth. Okay, it feeds forward, saying, hey, opposite depth. And then top-down feedback and come back to verify V1's report, because it's a bit ambiguous. And I say, oh, it means that the depth must be left and right, I must be shifted by this amount. And come back, it's not by this amount, it's not the other way, and then they get confused. Expected disparity and binocular correlation not found in V1. So therefore, V1 report is vetoed, and therefore, no reverse depth constant percept. That's the idea. This is only if you have feedback. But we said that feedback is in central vision and not peripheral vision, right? So if you don't have it in peripheral vision, then you believe the V1 report, which is fake news. V1 is reporting fake news, but you can't verify it. And so peripheral vision can be fooled by fake news, and central vision is less vulnerable. So that's the idea. And that's a prediction. Turns out that when people look at that, they always look in central vision. Oh, can I see the depth? They always put it in, they couldn't see, because naturally you're trying to see. And we tested it. In central vision, if the task for people to say is, well, this is in front or back, okay? So their chance level, 50-50 in central vision. Peripheral vision is much, much worse than chance. That means they see the opposite way. Yeah, they see the opposite depths. But of course, if it's the normal, non-fake news version, both central peripheral vision, they are 100% correct. Yeah. And so this is a prediction that's tested in this case. And I love to see physiological and anatomical prediction testing. But anyway, this is my motivation for a new path for understanding vision. The first example, and the idea is we need to put the selection right in the center of vision. Our vision is mostly blind, but we're so clever that we're not blind to the most important thing in the visual field, so that we don't get eaten by a tiger or hit by a car. And this means selection is one critical thing, because whatever you perceive is in your selected thing. And it looks like V1 is starting to do that. That's the first message. And second message is after, you know, the later stage, there should be a central peripheral dichotomy more than just phenomenological in terms of crowding or whatever. It's a computationally motivated framework and algorithms and so on. And I like to see the implementation tested. And this is a falsifiable framework, and these are my founding sources and collaborators. And thank you very much.
Where's calcium imaging in monkey V1? Do you think that's the best way to?
Lovely. I would love to see calcium imaging in monkey V1. Then you can find the winner. But another thing is you need to multiple layers. So it turns out this layer 2, 3 thing, then go to layer 5, then report it to superior curriculus. It will be also nice to see different layers. Can calcium image go to the layer 5? That will be nice. And also the layer 5 neurons, only 2% of them project to superior curriculus. So remember, it's picking winners. There's something else. It's kind of a corollary prediction. Is how do you pick winners when you have 100 million neurons and pick winners? It's like in an Olympic game, you want to pick the winner. But you can have tournaments. You know, you can have tournament. First of all, in your city, you get a winner. And so I think the tournament is done in layer 5, where you just pick the winners in the column. And then the tournament goes to the final, so you get the winner. And then the final is the visual field and that's. And I love to see these imaging different layers, you know, whether it's a neural pixel probe done. And another thing I like to discuss is rodents may be different. And of course, zebrafish doesn't have cortex, you know, it's organ superior curriculus and so on. And so this is something I like to look further. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't have a question. I just have like I second Alessandro that I love a lot when I see him, really. But I also want to that there is a tendency to equate between hierarchy, which is what you are, what I love about how you study the visual system here. And feed forward, which I do not love and never will. And so I think that this is just something that I would be very interested to talk to you, and I was just going to leave it, but then I thought that I would like to just attract everybody's attention to the notion that it would be not a good idea for people to walk out of here thinking that that all of this is, you know, sending us a message that V1 is doing the first sweep and that's it, okay? I think that it is doing a lot of that in the context of cellular. So, about that part of it. But feed forward plays a role in many senses. And, you know, just the fact that you find physiological effects of feedback, if you think about it, means that the system is not just feed forward, because otherwise the evolution would not bother with all the, you know, the synaptic. It's expensive to have these effects, and they're there because they have function. Okay, so that's just a little comment. Not
she has driven home.
Yes, you are helping me very well. Indeed, this feed forward study is opening the door for me to study feedback.
So,
yeah.
So, and this is where the Jean-Michel work comes in. This is not just, so, thank you. I think that people then equate feedback with a top-down volitional type of visual processing. And that part, I take issue with. I think that there is evidence that feedback plays a role also in automatic, involuntarily visual processing, okay? So that's the place where you and I need to talk about the details, but I just thought that I felt strongly to make the point to the audience that there is evidence for that. And you mentioned...
So you're right. I did not distinguish exactly in what sense the feedback is involuntary or voluntary, or it's kind of an automatically building circuit.
Or fast.
Yeah. And fast. And also, turns out that there is a difference between anesthetized and non-anesthetized animal. And that also makes the striate study very difficult, because whether it's volitional or not, you are changing the synaptic weights through anesthetization. So we have to be very careful.
Yeah.
So I'm very sympathetic to all these physiological study which the human will say, it didn't make any progress. Because it's so difficult, you can't just say it didn't make any progress. You know, it's a very difficult thing to study, yes.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.